This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to episode 361 of the More Than Just Code podcast. My name is Tim Mitra. I'm in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by Stuart Lynch in North Vancouver, British Columbia.
Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. So, I've been following some of your videos online and enjoying some of them. I really enjoyed that. Like, as you heard on the show, I really liked the one about trailing closures. It's one of those Swift concepts that I understand, but, you know, I think until you dove into it really deeply, it didn't really make a lot of sense to me, right? Like, cause I see people like, you know, they like either Xcode will, you know, shorthand it, or people will just dive right in expecting people to understand the nuances of it. So I found it really, the way you expounded on the various bits and pieces was really informative for me anyway.
Well, I didn't understand it either until I did. And actually, I'm working through a whole bunch of videos right now that are really just like that. I mean, there's a handful of things that, you know, I use all the time, but do I really understand what they are? So I'm trying to dig a little deeper on those kinds of things. Most recent one was KeyPath. So,
KeyPath, that's a tricky one too. You're right. Yeah. I mean, like, that's a kind of a secret sauce part of when all the authors at Raywinder, like I've talked to about, you know, Codico now, I guess, but I've talked to them over the years, and in a lot of cases, you know, we have an understanding of a subject, or we're interested in it, and we really don't become the experts until we actually write the book or write the video. And then then it's kind of burned in. But yeah, it's interesting how it takes a while to sort of get your head wrapped in. I'm curious, like, cause I'm self-taught, and I think you are too, right? Did you do a computer science in school though?
Or? No, I predated computer science even. So I took a couple of, punch card courses at the university when I was getting my math degree, but I wouldn't, you know, when I was teaching computer science, I was teaching far more sophisticated things than I ever learned, you know, so.
Yeah, well, actually, my sister did computer science. She was the first one in our family to do it, and I didn't go down that path, and my other two sisters didn't go down that path either. My dad was an engineer, so, you know, we always sort of had math and science in the house kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's funny because I was sort of in high school, I was kind of a C student, you know, if I put the effort in, I would have got A's and B's, but I just you know, couldn't, I was too busy living life. Right.
And you sound like my son.
Yeah. So, I think the next level up in terms of the math class, they did all the punch card stuff. And I just kind of saw them walking by with these shoeboxes full of punch cards and had no idea how far they were going. And it wasn't until I got into university that I was in a music course and I saw an Apple computer, Apple II, in the corner. Nobody was using it because nobody understood it. And that was my first sort of exposure to a computer that I could probably get my hands on. And then I think I saw SimClavier too. And if you've ever seen one of those things, it's all computerized synthesizer, sampler. Stevie Wonder used to have one, and Frank Zappa had one. That's how, you know, sophisticated they were. I never really got into computing until I got out into the working world and I was working as an artist, and we were looking at CAD/CAM. I remember CAD/CAM was the big buzzword back in the early 90s, I guess, late 80s. So that's when I got my first Mac, right? And never looked back, right? So
I predated any of those kinds of things. It wasn't until I started teaching that the Apples came out. Mm-hmm. And what year was that? 19?
Well, 77 was Apple, was the Apple thing. And then I think the Mac came out the year I graduated, which was 84. But so okay. it would have been Apple IIs, maybe. Apple was pretty big in education back then.
It was two pluses at the time, and then what they did was they dropped the number in schools to say, you know, are these things useful? And I picked one up, and they had basic AppleSoft Basic was built right into them. So and then you had these 5 1/4 inch floppy disks that you could code on. So I started writing some programs there because I was teaching math at the time and teaching graphing concepts. So, you know, you could plot pixels on the screen and make some adjustments to some quadratic formulas and plot different graphs. And you got this big TV screen that you'd wheel into the classroom and try and, you know, or do a flashcard kind of game or something like that. But
yeah. Was that like high school math you were doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Senior math. Yeah.
Okay, anyway, where'd you go from there? Like, how did you go from teaching into programming into like me, where you get into, did you get into the HTML and web and all that kind of stuff?
No, because that I was way before HTML too, because that didn't, you know, what happened was that as computers started to get more and more into schools, nobody really knew what to do with them. So they created a position at the district level for someone who could figure out how to, what to do with these kinds of things. So I was seconded to the school district to sort of go around. And at that point, there was a number of Commodore PET labs, Commodore 64 labs around, and yeah, people just weren't utilizing or making good use of them. But just at that time, there must have been this huge influx of money coming into school districts. I don't remember what the politics were. So we ended up getting a ton of money, enough to be able to afford to purchase a computer lab for every school. And the decision was to be, was to go to the new Mac, you know, with their Mac 512s, each one with a little 3¼-inch disc. So I ended up having to teach the entire district on how to use a Mac computer. And the strangest thing was the mouse, you know, and teaching people that they could actually lift the mouse up to move their hand, because you get these people that are reaching, you know, stretching their arm to move that mouse on the screen. So that whole hand-eye coordination thing was a huge thing because I was teaching educators at this point. I wasn't teaching the students. The teachers had to know how to use them, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah. That was at the board level. You weren't actually in a school. You were teaching other teachers.
Yeah. Well, I was teaching computer science on Apple IIs at the school, because I'd gone from math into computer science. You know, you developed your own curriculum and sort of taught whatever you felt like, basically.
Right.
Still predated any web. There was no internet at this point. And then, so I went to the district level and spent 2 years in that position. And then I ended up going in and spending 3 years as a high school vice principal, the worst 3 years of my entire life. It was just awful. But during that time, any district support sort of fell away. So here they had all these computers sitting there not doing anything. So they created a senior position at the district level as a director. And so I went from my vice principal's position into a director's position, where I had more authority over other staff to do things. And I spent, I don't know how many years, about 8 years, no, four years at that position before I moved to the Richmond School District and spent 12 years there. And that was a really good position, because then I had, in a senior staff position. So I had control over purchases and applications for both education and the business side of things. And they were an entire Mac district. So everything just sort of fit right in. And, you know, just that's how I sort of got involved in things. But, you know, I hate meetings and I hate sort of doing that kind of thing. So I always had to have a project that I could code and build applications that could help other people to do their jobs better. So I was forever writing little helper applications, you know, just doing different things in different languages. There were some PCs around as well. So some of the secondary offices were running still on Windows. So I had to write some apps in Visual Basic or something at that point too. But
sure. So this is in the Lower Mainland kind of area,
Richmond.
Richmond, BC. Yeah. So this would have been, I guess, like the mid 80s, early 80s, I guess.
No, right? This was now 1995. So between about 1985 to 95, I was in North Bend doing computer-based stuff and vice principal stuff. Right. And then I moved into Richmond, spent 12 years there. And then I took an early retirement and went and worked for a company. It was based out of Toronto in IT. So, yeah, that was an interesting story, because we had, I remember when I was working for the North Bend School District, email started to be a thing where people were saying, you know, it's, how are we going to communicate? And I remember the superintendent coming into my office one day and saying, how far away are we from email? And that just opened up sort of the pocketbooks. So I started to do some research on trying to find a product that would be easy to use, because at that point, all email was command line driven and not very friendly. And our users were all Mac-based users. And so I found a company out of Toronto that was called SoftArk that had a product called First Class that was big on the BBS systems.
I remember them, yeah.
Okay, so I ended up purchasing that for the school district, And the product grew and grew, and it was a really, really good email collaboration client because it had a really good sort of conferencing kind of system, sort of like a Slack based.
Yeah, it was Slack in a sense.
Like, yeah, but I think it was way better. But anyway, so when I moved to Richmond, I took that with me basically and said, look, we're going to have to implement this. They're using Quickmail and just it wasn't scaling. And at this point, the internet had sort of come on board. So there was a, you know, IP base. You could, you know, throw your server on that. Because my first server was a Mac 2 SE with a 20 megabyte hard drive with 12 modems hanging off it.
Wow.
So yeah. It was, yeah.
And how many people were you serving with that?
Oh, I was serving the whole school district. And what we did was, is I found another piece of software that allowed users to share over an AppleTalk network a single phone line. So they tapped into the office's fax line so that people could actually dial in. Of course, they could dial in from home. Everybody had a modem at that point, so they could all dial in. But it was still only 12 people at a time. But at the board office, we were on an Ethernet network, so we could all sort of communicate back and forth. But anyway, eventually it grew. And they had a application development environment called RAD, the Rapid Application Development Environment. It was kind of a Visual Basic kind of environment that you could build applications on top of it. So I could build applications that would allow me to query the SQL databases in the district and provide users with access to, you know, corporate information through, you know, password permissions and so on. So I built all these applications and then they had a web-based component as well. So I built a tool that allowed people to build and host websites just through putting information on a form, start to sell that through the school district. And the company, SoftArc First Class, they sort of took notice. And then they ended up paying the school district for my time for one day a week. And they'd fly me around the United States mostly, because this was before any Zoom and things like that. And I do presentations and talks to people. And eventually they made an offer that I couldn't refuse. And I ended up going and working for them. At this point, they are now owned by OpenText. It's another big software company. And so I went and worked for them for 7 years until OpenText sort of, they chew smaller companies up and then take the people they want and spit them out, you know. So, you know, I ended up losing my job at that point. And that's when I started iOS development.
So that took you right into like the, I wonder what, 2007, right?
No, 2014.
That's when you started iOS?
Yeah. As soon as Swift was released.
Oh, so you didn't suffer through Objective-C or anything like that?
No. I dabbled in Objective-C and I thought, nah, this is just way too confusing for me because, well, I mean, I had no background and just those square brackets and everything else were just, I didn't spend the time in it. Whereas when I was working for OpenText, I was doing a lot of JavaScript development for the web-based component too. So that whole syntax was very, very familiar with me and comfortable. You know, Swift is very similar to that.
Yeah.
So I just jumped into that and started to build apps and, you know, sort of built a whole bunch of apps that I put on the App Store and then realized I have to start to support those older versions. And so now I don't build apps much for myself anymore. Now I basically just do the YouTube thing because I find that more interesting, more rewarding.
So the indie app work that you did, like, was that, were you making any money off of those apps or just, you were just putting it out there for fun?
Yeah. Mostly it was for learning because I think I have 10 or 12 apps on the App Store, which three of them are making a little bit of money. Nothing that I could,
like pizza money.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, essentially.
Same with me.
and they all sort of scratched niche for me, right? These are things that I wanted. There may have been something on the App Store, and I could have paid my $4 for them, but there was always something missing in those apps that I wanted to do. So I would build an app and add what I wanted to be able to do. And so I just built those. And of those 10 or 12 apps, I use three of them still regularly. And, I've updated one of them right now, completely tore it down and rebuilt it in Swift UI because they were all UIKit apps.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, but it was fun, you know, because everyone used a different API and you learn through coding. You don't learn through watching, you learn from doing, right?
Right, exactly. So the YouTube channel was started up you were doing the teaching before, that's how you ended up with the YouTube idea, or?
Well, I had
Because I know you have some other, you have some pre-iOS stuff on your YouTube channel as well, right?
Yeah, that was all with First Class. So those
oh,
were,
was
so
oh,
I had,
okay.
Yeah, that was all First Class stuff. And there was a OpenText First Class YouTube channel eventually. So I first started putting all that stuff on my own YouTube channel, and then OpenText created their own channel. So I did a few hundred videos for them. And so I was the voice of their videos for First Class. So I knew what that was all about. But when I started learning coding or Swift development, I don't think I did a very good job of learning. And I took one of those courses where, you know, you learn how to be an iOS developer in 3 weeks, you know, when you build 12 apps, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And sort of the typical kind of stuff where it's not best practices at all. It's basically churn out an app, but you don't really know what you're doing. You're just copying things. And in fact, the way that I would learn or build my apps was, let me do a Stack Overflow search, find out somebody who's done something similar, copy that code, and then paste it into my app and massage it, and paste it into my app and try to get it to work. Well, that's not sustainable, right? Because you don't understand what you're doing.
I actually taught a course, like a 3 or 4 day introduction course back in the early days, just getting people, we would build a calculator, you know, like by lunch, I get you to build, you know, the typical, my hello, and then my name is, and then hit okay. And then it would reply, hey, you know, Stuart, how are you? Kind of thing. And then we'd build a calculator. And so I think at one point we had built a Flappy Bird app kind of thing. And that was just to get people who, a lot of the courses I taught were like corporate, companies would send people in. In fact, I taught at TD Bank, you know, years before I actually worked there. But yeah, same sort of thing. Like, and I did teach at a boot camp once, and I didn't last very long because I didn't like the philosophy of they give you the assignment and then they say go read waywardluck.com or go over here and just you put it together. I mean, they did a lecture during the morning and kind of explained, you know, what was going on, you know, concepts they wanted you to learn. But yeah, it was all up to the students. And I just thought that was crazy. But plus, you know, now that I know, you know, I don't know, you may have heard, or if you've listened to our show, I wrote an article on how to keep learning after 50, right? Which, you know, you and I both can relate to. And a friend of mine turned me on to neuroplasticity, and I learned that that's not the way to learn. You can't learn a new skill by just cramming for 3 weeks. You know, it just doesn't work that way.
No, it's yeah, exactly. It's definitely through experiencing things in multiple different ways. At least that's the way I see it. But because when I was learning, I end up talking out loud when I'm watching videos of other people and asking questions. And in fact, you know, being older, I'm not afraid to ask questions. So I would, if people have videos, I would start to ask questions as to why did you do it this way? Why did you do it that way? And sometimes you can answer, sometimes you don't. Sometimes people take offense as if I'm challenging them. When in fact, what I'm really doing is I'm just trying to confirm whether or not I understand something.
Right.
And yep. So, and then, you know, you worked for the Ray Wenderlich and did their material, and I subscribed to them and have been a subscriber for a long time. But I also found that their material was too advanced for me at the time because they would provide code for a particular topic, but all that background code was really quite sophisticated for somebody who was just learning. And so, you know, or they would start out really slow and all of a sudden they'd jump right into something that was really sophisticated. And so, you know, back and forth. So I got bits and pieces of what I wanted out of that, but it wasn't sort of a linear approach. So
I'll tell you what I don't like about Ray Wenderlich's approach. I mean, no offense. I mean, it's not Ray, it's Codico. It's not Ray doesn't do the actual teaching, but is whenever I, cause I have access to all the material and every now and then I grab one of their tutorials and go through it. What I don't like about it as a student is that, you know, they'll start you off with an application that's pretty well baked, you know, and then they'll, cause they're trying to teach you a concept like MapKit or whatever it is, the you know, idea of the day. I'd much rather start from nothing. I'd rather start from scratch and go through each sort of step even like I take beginner courses all the time because I want to get an understanding of where they're coming from in terms of where they wanted to go, like where the course is going. And so yeah, I don't like it when, you know, somebody I read a book or whatever and it says go to the GitHub and download this half-baked app, because I'm not learning anything. I may be learning the bits and pieces that are after the fact, you know, like even the concept of what we were talking about earlier was your trailing closure course, right? You didn't tell me to start from the middle and then explain to me what trailing code. You started from the very beginning with an empty playground, which, you know, to me as a student, that's a much better way to go. In fact, the one or two courses that I did for Ray start with, you know, open up an empty app and an empty project and start here and do this, right?
I agree. You know, that it's sometimes that I do have starter projects, but I always sort of go through the code to explain that code, and I'll get criticized. I mean, I've had comments like, just shut up already and get to the point.
Right? Yeah.
And it just goes to show you that there's,
well, maybe you put a chapter marking and say, if you can skip ahead to chapter two or chapter three.
Yeah. And I've done that a couple of times actually, you know, so just jump to here. I do put chapter markers in the, you know, introduction, and then people can jump to it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I get asked often to, you know, would I put together a full course, like a Udemy course on learning how to code? Problem is that with that is that I would never sort of get to something, because I'd always want to stretch something out. And in the end, you know, if some simple application that somebody could build in a very short period of time, it would take me a long time, because I want to sort of, here's a concept. So how does that concept work? So let's go back and sort of drill down. And I do that now, but fortunately, because I've got a number of videos already out there, if I'm teaching something, what I can say is, like, if you want more information on this, here's this video where I cover this particular topic in more depth. So like that trailing closure one, if I'm doing something and I sort of glance over it, I'll say, look, if you don't quite understand what I did, you can now go back and watch that video. So that's the advantage of sort of building up a library of these kinds of things, which are great for me too, because I go back. Oh, for example, today I always forget the syntax for the new iOS 15 alerts in SwiftUI because it changed. So I had to put an alert in this app that I'm modifying right now, and I couldn't remember, God, what is the syntax for that? So I just go down and pick up my old application, or the actual project that I created for that video, and there's the code, and you know, I can pick it up and use that code. But yeah, I'm constantly going back to my old stuff because I don't use this stuff every day, right? So
Well, when we started our app company, I had an intern working for me, and I would say to him, "Okay, I want to do this, but I'm sure somebody has." I wasn't really aware that they hadn't, but I'm sure somebody out there has at least tried this. And there were a lot of sites, you know, when Ray was first starting up his site, there was a lot of sites. Ray was good for bits and pieces, but there were like these cookbook sites, like I forget what they were called them, but you know, like they'd have like little snippets of how to do this kind of thing, or you know, like a little animation or something. This was Objective-C, of course, but rather than, you know, spending the time, like, you know, the old story, you don't want to reinvent the wheel, right? You know, if somebody's already done it, like you said, with Stack Overflow, now we've got ChatGPT we can ask, right? You know, just write this up for me and you know, and tweak it kind of thing. You know, the prompt programming that ChatGPT uses. But that's how we kind of built it together. We had one senior guy who did all the heavy lifting of the main architect of the app. But then myself and my intern would go through and just sort of pick and choose bits and pieces and kind of learn as we went. Same sort of yeah. deal, right?
Well, I mean, and I do that. I mean, I use ChatGPT every day. In fact, that's how I really started to understand KeePass, which the latest video that I'm doing right now, is that I asked it for some examples. I says, you know, show me why I would use, or give me a couple of examples of why I would use KeePass. So it gave me some examples, and I says, well, and I'm having this conversation with him. I says, that's not really a clear example, because you could do this. And he goes, yes, you're exactly right. Here's another example. And then I would go through it and says, well, no, that's not a clear example either, because there's no benefit there. Yes, you're right. In this case, it's probably not a good example. So I says, well, can you give me an example that would be really clear? And it gave me this example that just set this light bulb off for me, you know, realizing that key pass or types that could be passed into functions. I mean, bingo, now we have a reason why KeePass are really important. And I love that when I get that sort of light bulb moment where things open up and so now the key is, how do I turn that around and explain that to somebody else in a sequential manner without sort of jumping in at the middle? How do I start back at the beginning? And that's why half of my videos take, you know, half hour or more, because I don't want to, I want to sort of build up to it. Right. So there's a progression.
Yeah. I mean, like I don't know if I'd watched a few of your videos in the past, but yeah, it wasn't like, for me, the light bulb moment was, there was the trailing closure one. Not so much that I mean, and to be honest with you, you know, the best part for me wasn't so much that I needed to learn how to do trailing closures or whatever. It's that, so that I could understand when I see a trailing closure being used, I know what stage of that there, of that, you know, abstraction they're at, right? You know, I remember like you know, because sometimes I'll go into a new code base and I'll look around and it's so abstracted. Like, you're like, what am I looking at? What is happening here? And then you have to sort of, you, Mark and I were talking about this on the show the other day. We both kind of go backward through the code and follow the callers and look at, you know, look at the definitions and you know, go down these little, almost like little rabbit holes to sort of find out, how did you get to this level here, right? So, because I mean, the whole, you know, that you know, that I'm just going to probably butcher this, but yeah, the you get the parenthesis and then the arrow and then the parenthesis. To me, that means nothing. You know, but you know, having gone through the exercise with you, it actually made a lot more sense. But because you know, that's because I think for a lot of people, they would probably stop before they get to that kind of abstraction. You know, they would kind of, because at the end of the day, like I'm from the 80-20 school of thought, where you don't need to have it 100%. Perfect, right? You can, mm-hmm. if it's at 80% and it does the thing you need it to do, ship it. Like it's ready to go, move on to the next thing, kind of thing, right? So I think that's a difficult thing to learn. I've worked with tons of people, creatives and engineers, who will just keep building and building and building and never actually get something out the door, kind of thing, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm at the point now where, I mean, because when you're doing something or teaching something on YouTube, you're basically opening yourself up for criticism. So you better, I have to feel like I have to know what I'm talking about. And I mean, there's a danger there, because people then assume that you know everything, when in fact you don't, right?
Yeah.
You know what you're talking about.
Don't just allow people to figure it out.
Well, I've mentioned that to other people. I says, you know, cause people will say, you know, I mentor a number of people right now, and I'll get other people saying, can you help me with this? And I said, I haven't got a clue what that stuff's about. I've just never touched it. It doesn't interest me, like SpriteKit. I'm not interested in that. I couldn't help anybody in that, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But when I'm teaching, I write a script. And so you'll never see me talking and coding at the same time. I just can't do that. So
yeah,
I'll write a loose script first. I'll record the video. Mm-hmm. Then I'll go back and write a detailed script that I will record in audio. Then I'll put the audio together with the video. And I'll have to make sure that I always confuse braces and brackets and parentheses.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got this little text snippet that I have in front of me with pictures of this is a bracket, this is a brace, so that when I'm writing the script, I make sure that I use the right word.
Sure, yeah.
You know, and because people will correct you on that, you know, especially, you know, I said depreciated, I don't know how many times, instead of deprecated, you know, and people are really quick to jump on that one.
I host a podcast, I'm 8.5 years in, and I use the wrong word all the time. I'm constantly getting corrected by my co-hosts.
The most recent was when I did a video on the new, I call them the new detentes. Is the detents, you know, they look like detents to me. I called them detents in the video and got corrected on that one. But so people are good to criticize you when you make mistakes. But I worry about that. I have a real thin skin, right? I mean, you always remember the critical comments. You never remember the good ones, but the critical ones really dig deep, right?
Yeah, I mean that is obviously a danger too. I think about that every time I write a tweet. You know, like I'm not on Twitter to cause grief. I'm on Twitter to inform people. Like, if I find something that's useful, like your stuff, I'll retweet it, or Daniel's stuff, I'll retweet that, you know, kind of thing. Sometimes I'll add my own two cents to it. But yeah, I'm always like, whenever I write a new tweet, even if it's just a joke or whatever, I'm always concerned that somebody's going to bark back at me. I've only ever been, that I know of, I've only ever been blocked once, you know. Yeah. And it wasn't, and yeah. I was trying to be helpful. I wasn't trying to be critical or whatever, but it's unfortunate. But the, it's difficult. It's difficult in a public forum to sort of put your stuff out there. Like, you know, even when I was teaching, like, I was always afraid that somebody was going to ask me why something. And like you said, like the same thing, even when I was teaching, I had like a typewritten, a printed out step-by-step kind of thing. And, you know, I was going through teaching people how to do stuff, and it was the same deal. It was exactly like you just described, 100%. Like you have it written out, and you rehearse it, and then you present it, and you know, hopefully you get it right. Right. So I'm amazed at people like Paul Hudson who can just do it off the cuff. Like,
yeah, there's a few guys that are like that. I'm amazed by them. I got burned once really bad a couple of years back, and I spent so much time trying to apologize because I thought that I was not understood. It was somebody on YouTube or if it was Twitter or whatever had talked about them being self-taught. And I tweeted innocently, you know, I prefer to use the term self-directed because I believe that we are directed by learning from others. Because what does self-taught actually mean? You know, you've got to be really smart to be self-taught.
True.
And people took that as that I was criticizing this person for saying that they were self-taught.
Oh, yeah.
And I said, no, it's just another phrase. I never use the word that I'm self-taught. I always say I'm self-directed because I've learned from everybody else, right? And it was just semantics, but boy, did I get ripped for that. And, you know, I lost sleep over that, right? And, you know, no ill intention.
Yeah, it's funny. Well, I always joke because it reminds me of high school, because exactly the same thing. Like, I lose sleep over things I say or in meetings at work and exchanges I have online and stuff like that. Yeah, it's a worrying thing. But I think that just means we're human, right? You know?
Yeah, I suppose.
But you're right. Yeah. I mean, like even like, you know, even babies learn to speak by listening to the noises that their parents make and then trying to imitate those noises to the point where they can say, can I have some more milk? And their mother's mind explodes because right. They're able to communicate. It's funny, like, you know, one of my nieces taught her daughter to sign. You know, so she could say, I want more milk, or I want, you know, I need to go outside before she could actually form the words, which was kind of amazing thing about the way the brain works, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
Well, my dog nose bumps. So he knows when it's time to go out. Yeah, he comes up and bumps me with his nose, and he knows what time it is, right?
Yeah, my dog, I swear, we listen to CBC all the time, right? So he gets fed at 6 o'clock. So I think the cue of that, you know, the theme music from the news show is what sets him off. But you're right. But he starts around 4:30 and starts looking and, you know, wagging his tail and hoping to get fed.
Yeah, they're smart.
I don't know what else. So I do want to ask you, like, a couple of articles you wrote. One is like, can I call myself a software developer? Can you explain a bit of the context behind that one?
Yeah. The whole imposter inferiority complex, you know, I felt like I was probably 10, 20 years too soon for what I really wanted to do. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I've always wanted to do. I've always loved coding. Mm-hmm. I love teaching, but I always wanted to code. And never feeling like I was good enough, that everybody was always smarter than me. People, you know, amazed at the developers at OpenText that would put together these products. And so, you know, at what point can you call yourself a software developer? Everybody's got their own opinion. So that's what that post was all about. You know, okay, here I am. I've got 10 or 12 apps on the App Store. Can I call myself a software developer now? Because that's really... when I grow up is what I want to be, kind of thing, right?
Yeah. When's that going to be?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, that was the whole thing behind that one.
I hear people a lot of times will want to know, okay, so they want to know exactly what are the five steps that you go through, or what's the checklist to say, okay, now, you know, Stuart, you're a software developer. To me, yeah, like you're in the same way, I think I had 30 apps on the App Store that I wasn't necessarily the complete architect for. I was like probably the product manager or the engineering manager. I did a lot. I did some of the work. I did some of the artwork on them. I basically brought all the pieces together. I'm the one that actually submitted it to the App Store. I got paid for it, you know. So all of those things, that make me a software developer. And now I'm actually, my title now is engineering manager. And as a Canadian, you know, I feel awkward about saying software engineer, you know, but especially somebody from Ontario. You know, it's interesting that at what point do you become a software developer? And I thought I was a software developer all along. And it wasn't until I started interviewing for jobs, you know, when we had that, you know, the indie apocalypse, we called it, when, you know, when the App Store, everybody on the, every app on the App Store had to be free and nobody could make money off it anymore. That's when a lot of us decided to go look for work, right? And this is what I have been doing for the last 5 years or so. So I figured I would go and give it a shot. And when can you call yourself a software engineer? I guess is the answer that people want to know. Like, I see this on conversations about this on with people on Slacks and Twitters, you know, what is the path to become a software engineer? What's the path to become an iOS engineer? It's a challenging question, right? And I think, you know, if you've made an app and you're happy to put it out there, away you go, right? I mean, same as when I was a web developer, I thought it was cool. I thought it was magical to make a website and that people could from around the world could look at. I had a hockey pool and, you know, I was scraping data off of sports sites to get the statistics and then putting into my SQL. To me, that was magic. And that's the part of why I do what I want to do that makes me want to do this thing, right? So I come at it maybe from an artist point of view that it's just, these are just tools and brushes and they just take a different shape, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, some people could say you can call yourself a software developer when you can make enough money to live.
Yeah.
You know? But others will say it's, well, if you've developed an app, you're a software developer. I always feel embarrassed. I still wouldn't say that I was, you know, I like to think that I could at least qualify now for some sort of a junior job, but mm-hmm. You know, that's, I'm a fast learner though. So, you know, I think that anything that I could grow into, but, yeah, you know, it's a question that I ask myself. You know, I'm always embarrassed. I would never say that I am. You know, I tell people what I do, but I would never say that as a software developer.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I haven't actually painted a painting in probably 20 years or so or more, but I still think of myself as a painter and a sculptor because that's what I, you know, and now I'm sculpting in 3D and stuff like that. But it's the same muscle as being used in creating iOS apps in my head that you know, lets me put art on, or paint on a painting. And so the other article you wrote was, can you call yourself a YouTuber, I guess, right?
YouTuber. Yeah.
What do the kids say these days? But yeah, so how do you, what criteria does that make for you? Are you, I mean, I guess let's be blunt. Are you making a living off of YouTubing?
No. How can you make a living off of YouTube? You know, I've got, what have I got? 12,000-13,000 subscribers.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, my most recent video, I got about in the first 3 days about 1200 views or 1200 views, you know, $5 in revenue, you know, that kind of thing. So wow. You know, I get about 32,000 views a month on my videos. That doesn't amount to, you know, pizza money, you know, for
that.
So I don't do it for the money. I'm fortunate though, because I've got a pension, you know, everything's okay. I'm not in it for the money. So it's basically, you know, when you start out and you look at people like Chris Ching, who's got 500,000 subscribers on his YouTube channel. Paul Hudson is approaching his 100,000 subscriber. Sean Allen's got, I guess he's over 100,000. Other people are that, you know, so I look at the people that I watched and I learned from.
Sure.
And thinking, okay, when can I say that I'm sort of at that particular level? Well, I'll never be at those levels, but, you know, I'm approaching a level at which I'm getting enough recognition, I suppose, from people that I'm providing content that's worth watching, and sort of the message is getting out there. So, no.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a tipping point. I mean, because I remember when Sean Allen first started, because I started watching his videos. He wasn't even an iOS engineer or developer at that point. He was saying, I'm going to learn how to be a developer, and I'm going to make these videos at the same time. And so his first couple of years, if you watch his videos, are all about, you know, things he'd been learning as an engineer. And now, yeah, like he's completely different. I mean, I think Tammy and I interviewed him about 3 years ago, I guess. And he was just that, you know, he hadn't kind of hit that mark yet. But yeah, now he's a name people know. And same thing with Ray. I mean, Ray Wunderlich, he was just a guy who had a blog, and he put up a couple of articles on how to write iOS apps. And then slowly he built a team. And then next thing he knows, like, he and his wife are like, do we do this full time, or what do we do? Right.
Yeah.
And they just rebranded, you know, recently, and that's part of it, because, you know, it's not a single guy. It's been for a long, I mean, I joined them in 2014, and they were about 125 authors altogether, you know, and they had, I think they had 10 employees at the time. And yeah, now it's like I've watched that company kind of grow as well. Right. Over time. Yeah. So, yeah, I think you kind of reach a tipping point, like where I have another podcast called Spotcast, and we're just floundering along. We're like maybe 60, 70 listens per episode kind of thing. And it kind of peaks and it kind of slowly grows. But when we started More Than Just Code, it was the same sort of thing. We were first couple of years, it was just very much three guys in a room just talking to each other about iOS. And now I'm constantly surprised when I stumble across a website that says, here are the 10 podcasts you need to listen to. And we're in there somewhere.
Yeah. Know, well, I mean,
I'm not making any money off this either. So
no, I know. But I mean, when you mentioned one of my videos and Daniel, you know, he knew who I was, and Jordy Bruin was on another launch podcast, and yeah, I loved what he said. He sort of thinks of me as his old math teacher, because that's where he would learn concept from me. Right. So yeah. You know, that's confirmation that I must be doing something right.
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know, the key for me right now is trying to find out, well, you know, what does my channel represent to people? You know, where do I fit within this niche of people who are creating videos on YouTube? And that's what I'm struggling with right now, is like, what does my content look like? Where do I go from now? I've got,
let me give you, I think the idea of you're my favorite math teacher is a great concept, because, you know, I went to a high school in Toronto, and every single person that I know that studied art at this particular school studied under a man named Mr. Samatoka. And he had an arrangement with us, and he would say at the beginning of the year, you can do studio art for half the year, and you can do art history for half the year. And he insisted on the art history part of it. And we got to choose whether we wanted to do studio first or art history. And, you know, we would pick one or the other. And he had amassed a set of, like you and I, he had amassed a set of slides that he'd compiled out of books and going to places. And he had this amazing library of art history. And, every single student to a T will say the same thing. I learned so much from that guy that he changed my life. And I think that's, for me, that's the reason I do what I do I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago on a show. I saw a talk by a friend of mine named Ryan Nystrom, who you may have seen. He's the IG list guy, IG something, like, he worked for Facebook for a while, and he wrote this open source tool that everybody uses now. But he had done a talk at Ray Wunderlich about inspiring other people. And he said, you know, you may this counters anybody who's watching this show's imposter syndrome, is you may know one thing that somebody else doesn't know. And by sharing that information with them, you can actually make their day, their life better. Right. Even though it's just one thing that you know better or more efficiently than they do. Right. So by being out here and being everybody's favorite math teacher, you know, I think over time you'll have a great influence. Right. So, and I get that from your voice. I mean, like, I listen to your videos. I mean, you know, you have a distinct style, I think. Right. Like you're like definitely know I'm watching one of your videos when I'm watching one, right? As opposed to Paul Hudson's or something from the Ray Winwood group, right? So, because I think just keep doing what you're doing. I think you're really inspiring people.
Well, I appreciate that. There isn't one style for everybody, and
sure.
And we all learn from get bits of pieces from everybody else, right? It's just you know, how can I spread the word? Because I think I do have content that is worthwhile, not necessarily for the beginner. So, you know, but I don't know, some people learn more from, I mean, I learn more now from reading than I do from watching other people's videos, but,
sure.
I don't know. It's an ongoing thing and coming up with topics hasn't been all that difficult, but recently I've sort of been struggling a bit with, you know, what am I going to do next? And because the topics are getting deeper and deeper and I'm spending more and more time sort of researching them so that I can. And it's like I craft a story almost. I mean, it may not seem like it, but there's a beginning and an end, and I've got to find the right examples that are going to take me into the next and sort of this whole flow. So I can't sit down like some people do, and like Muhammad Azam, you know, Azam Sharp. I mean, he records and bangs off a video in the morning before he does his real job in the work, you know. And I don't know how people do that. I just can't. So I really do have to plan and you know, go through it in much more detail. So that's just how my videos are done.
Here's hoping Apple introduces some new concepts for you to write some videos about in a couple of months.
Well, it was great last year. I got 17 videos out of one. So yeah, right from August right through till December, I was doing videos. Because I only do one a week, but that's enough because it's time consuming for sure.
Yeah, no. I even producing this show, it does add up in terms of time, and I've gotten, you know, to the point where it's I'm pretty good at it, but you know, and then I tweak things as I go, and they get better hopefully over time. But yeah, keep going at it. So I have this part of the show where I like to sort of turn the tables and just sort of throw some random questions at you, based on Marcel Proust and Stephen Colbert's questionnaire. So. If you're
okay,
open
great.
To it, I can just sure. throw some random questions at you and hopefully we'll learn a little bit more about you. But we'll start with the one I always start with, which is, what's your motto?
What's my motto? Oh, brother.
Like, what's the unique reason why people come to you? What do you hope to achieve?
Oh, I should have prepped for this.
No, you can't study for this test.
I think it's probably more than anything, it's just be kind. And in that, I mean... If somebody asks me a question, don't dismiss them. You know, don't sure. be judgmental. So,
yeah, cool. All right. Who are your favorite writers?
One of my favorite writers is I like sort of the detective novels. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I love the Swedish and the Scandinavian genre. So, like Joe Nesbo and those kinds of things. But I really like Robert Galbraith.
Oh,
because the Cormoran Strike novels are some of my favorite novels that I read. So.
Oh, well, and that, let's follow up with, who's your favorite hero of fiction?
Oh, right now, I think it's Cormoran Strike.
What's the scariest animal?
Spiders.
Spiders?
Okay. Yeah.
What's the best sandwich?
Oh, grilled cheese on sourdough. Grilled ham and cheese on sourdough. I mean, this is what I have almost every single day.
Really? Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And do you dip it in ketchup or just straight up grilled cheese? Yeah?
Straight up, yeah.
Have you ever asked anybody for their autograph?
Yeah, I have actually. When I was in the 70s, I traveled around Europe with a friend, and we ended up we were traveling between Hamburg and Copenhagen, and got on a ferry. Ended up meeting a rock promoter who was promoting a number of groups that were traveling around at the time. Mm-hmm. So we ended up in Copenhagen, working in Copenhagen, doing light shows for different bands. Emerson, Lake and Palmer and nice. The band. So we ended up after a show doing all that. So I was able to collect a number of autographs from them. And then what really got me going was when we left, when they finished the in Copenhagen, they were heading towards Germany. And this is 1971, by the way. Chicago, the group Chicago was just, they would just had been Chicago Transit Authority, and then they changed right. the name to Chicago and were traveling around. They were going to be in Germany. So I played in the band, and the guy that I traveled with, the other two guys I traveled with were in our band. So I played horn, I played sax. One guy played bass and the other guy was a drummer. So we heard that Chicago was going to be in Munich. So we drove our car, ended up going to Munich, finding the hall. And as we got into the hall there, the roadies for Chicago were having their tearing their hair out because it just wasn't set up properly. And they said out loud, because we had sort of snuck in through the gates and into the side door because we figured we could hide in a washroom until the concert started or something like that. And so they ended up sort of saying, you know, doesn't anybody understand what we want? So we says, well, we do. So we ended up doing setup for Chicago on that show. And then they asked us to join the road team to travel with Chicago throughout Germany. So anyway, long story, those are the autographs that I had to ask people for when I was sort of in that roadie kind of a
genre. Cool.
Yeah. Anyway.
That's a good story. What words or phrases do you overuse the most?
I try not to use A.
Yeah.
That's an Eastern thing.
Yeah. Like, but you mean like the Canadian A?
Yeah. And you know, that really bothers me when I meet somebody and they're American or whatever. The first thing they say is, how's it going, eh?
Yeah.
And I says, in Vancouver, we don't really say that. It's, you know, we're more California. But I don't know if I have anything that I say over and over again. It's something that I try to avoid.
Mm. Well, I can tell you from having lived in Ontario living in Vancouver, it's a very different part of the country. Like,
it is.
Yeah. Definitely, for sure. What's the one thing you own that you should really throw out?
Yeah, right now, my skis.
Okay. What's the most used app on your phone?
Well, probably Overcast.
Overcast? Yeah. You don't want to check the time on your phone there? And
where do I find that under?
It's under general.
Screen time? Oh, no.
Screen time.
Yeah, it's Overcast. I do a lot of walking. And yeah. So that takes up a couple hours a day. Listen to podcasts.
Yeah, podcasts and Audible books too. Audio books too is for me.
Yeah,
I'll ask you a fun one. Well, I can ask you this one: Star Trek or Star Wars?
Star Trek, but
yeah,
the original Star Trek.
Okay, the original TOS. Yeah.
Yeah.
What living person do you admire the most?
Probably my wife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right.
She's the, you know, she. To live with me, she has to be good.
Yeah.
To put up with me.
Where would you most like to live?
Oh, Hawaii.
Hawaii?
Yeah.
Nice there, yeah. That's, which island, though?
Now, Maui. In Maui. That's where I go every year. So I used to spend a lot of time in Oahu.
Yeah.
But now it's Maui.
Yeah, I only went to Hawaii once, and then we went to Maui for about 10 days, and then we went to Kauai, and it was a completely different experience. Maui is really nice.
Oh, in Maui, everybody goes to bed at 8 o'clock and you're up at 6.
Yeah.
And you just enjoy the surf. And
well, Maui's where they have the roosters too, or they all
three. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is it only Maui or streets. Is it the whole place?
Yeah. I've only been to Maui and Oahu, but roosters are definitely big.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently, there was some ship or something that capsized, and that's how they ended up going feral.
Is that right?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Window or aisle?
Oh, aisle.
Okay.
I have to. I'm 6'4". I need to get foot out in the aisle. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. True.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing that's annoying is when they go by with the cart. That's the part I don't like about the aisle. If you only had to listen to one song for the rest of your life, what is it?
Lowdown by Boaz Skaggs.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. Yeah, I like that one. I kind of got tired of him, and then I saw him with the Boys of Summer. Did you ever hear about that group? It was Michael McDonald, Donald Fagen, and Boaz Skaggs. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
And they did like each other's songs. He's a really amazing musician. Like even when he was just playing with the other guys, playing their stuff. Because he had that one hit he had Lowdown hit, right? And
yeah, well, yeah, he said lots of stuff. I was a big fan. He's just going on tour again, by the way. So he's been around. But Steely Dan, Donald Fagen, I mean, that's good stuff too. Yeah.
Yeah, I got to see them a few times before Walter passed away.
Yeah.
What's your favorite action movie?
Yeah, probably Batman.
Which one?
You know, Batman Returns.
Batman Returns.
But I'm not a huge Batman or not a huge action movie fan.
Which Batman is the Batman Returns one? Which Batman?
I think that was the one with
the new one, the newer
Christian,
guy.
Yeah. No, Christian Bale. Christian Bale.
Have you seen the new one with Robert Pattinson?
No.
It's actually pretty good. Describe the rest of your life in 5 words.
Yeah, survival. I mean, there's not that many years left, right? So it's just make the most out of what time I've got left.
Okay, cool. That's you know that Al Jaffe just passed away, and he was 102.
Oh, really?
102.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I do think about this a lot because, I'm 72 in another week, right? So that's getting up there.
Yeah.
And if I look back 20 years, that's as clear as a bell. I can remember exactly what I was doing 20 years ago. That, I was still working at the time, but projecting 20 years into the future, you know, maybe not, right? 92, am I still going to be around? So it's just a matter of just staying busy, keeping my mind sharp and just doing what I do and trying to hit as many sunspots as I can.
Yeah. Yeah. I was in a coaching program at one point and they asked us to say, what year are you going to die? Right. You had to sort of put a number. And I had a horoscope done when I was like, a kid. My father was big into, he's Indian, so he's big into horoscopes, and 72 was my number. Right.
Yeah.
And this coaching program, was all about, learning to do the work you love to do, to get paid for the work that you love to do, to, take care of yourself, to be healthy. And you learned all these sort of life skills about how to make your life as an entrepreneur better, how to build up a company, how to take care of yourself, how to be healthy. And then the question they gave us after learning a bunch of these things was, now how old are you going to be when you die? Because why would you die at 72, right? Like, why do you have to draw that line in the sand and drive yourself to that point? I'm always amazed, like how long people live. I mean, like, of course, like you, I've got friends and, my father died 2 years older than I am now. So, but he was, he's a lifetime smoker and all that kind of
same
stuff.
Same as mine, right? But yeah, right now though, time is really important to me. And we're hoping to go to Europe this fall.
Mm-hmm.
But my wife's passport expired and she had just sent her passport in for renewal. And now with this strike that's on in Canada, who knows what the status is going to be? I can't book a trip until I get her passport.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, God, I can't, there's only certain times of the year I want to go to Europe. I don't want to lose another year because we've lost 3 years due to COVID.
Right.
What do we do? So young people don't think about that, but to me, it's important,
There's
only so much time left.
No, you're right. I'm at the age now where obviously I'm starting to think about that too, because my sister, who's a year younger than me, started talking about retirement 2 years ago. I'm like, what? I hadn't even thought about that. Like, I don't think I'm going to retire if I don't have a choice. I mean, I retired from the current job I'm at, maybe, but
yeah.
I'm going to go work at the Apple store or something, part-time.
Well, and this is why I do what I do. I mean, I just can't imagine what I would do if I wasn't putting out videos.
Sure.
When I got let go from OpenText, I was doing consulting and doing training and all this kind of stuff because there was a gap there. There was still a need. So when this came along to do YouTube videos, this is what keeps me going. This is what keeps me busy. I don't have to worry about getting a job and I'm financially secure. So everything is good that way. But I do like vacations.
Cool. Well, I think we're going to wrap up. So if people want to get in touch with you, find out where you're, follow you, what's your 411? How will they find you?
Yeah, I mean, everything is basically on social media is Stuart Lynch. This is my full name. So Twitter, Mastodon at iosdev.space, I guess is what it is. And I have a website, this Createx Solutions that I have. But my YouTube channel, if you just go to my YouTube channel, all my links are on any one of my videos. So probably the best place to find me. But I'm certainly open to DMs and emails and just love to communicate with people. And one day I hope to get a conference, go to a conference and meet people for real.
Have you ever thought about putting a talk in?
I've submitted a talk. I submitted a couple, got rejected on one. So I've submitted for Swift Leads. Who knows if that's going to come
or
not.
Did you try Swift TO as well in Toronto?
I didn't. And I probably should have, but maybe next year if I'm still around.
Well, I can tell you, Jaime, he puts in 10, 20. He puts in a ton and maybe gets one. So,
yeah, I know. It's a crapshoot. I mean, and everybody, and my talk probably wouldn't be technical, it would be more philosophical, just on
Yeah.
You know, being old and coding and keeping active and being well, relevant, you know.
yeah, I'm thinking, I think we need to have a graybeard club, not to exclude the ladies, but yeah, we'll have a
Yeah.
older coder club. I'm thinking because
Yeah.
I'm running into a lot of people like myself who have the same challenges that I do, right? So,
Yeah. But
yeah.
you know what? Before, just, I mean, I know that it's getting on time-wise, but there are a lot of retired people in their 50s, 60s that are just starting to code.
Yeah.
And that those are the people that are reaching out me to me more than anybody else.
Wow,
So
okay.
all of the people, just about everyone that I've been mentoring over the last few years, they've all been 50, 60 plus, and they're doing it because they need something to do. They've always sort of wanted to. They've had this idea, and I think that's great. You know, it's a great way to stay active and to keep your mind sharp.
Yeah, I was actually thinking of maybe writing a book for older folks who were just getting into this game, right? You know, like I was 50 when I started iOS. I mean, I was doing coding before that, but yeah, I didn't even think about my age when I started. I just started doing it, right? So go figure. All right, my name is Tim Mitra, TimMitra on the Twitter machine, the Mastodon, all those kind of things is where you'll find me. And so until next time, see you later. And that's it.
Thanks, Tim.
Oh, I forgot to say,
Thanks.
hey, if you're listening on YouTube, click over here, hit the subscribe button.
This has been another episode of the More Than Just Code podcast. If you want to find out more about the show, you can visit the More Than Just Code website at mtjc.fireside.fm. There you can find a summary and show notes of each episode. We list links to the apps, code, and news that we mentioned on the show. If you like the podcast, tell your friends, leave a comment on the website, or write a review on iTunes. And please recommend us in your favorite podcatcher. All of these things help others find out about the show. We really appreciate your help with spreading the word. We're also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love to hear from you, so use the hashtag AskMTJC and we may mention you on the show. Friends of the show can also join us on the podcast Slack channel. Once again, the podcast Twitter account is at MTJC_podcast. Please consider supporting the show by pledging any amount on patreon.com/MTJC. Every dollar pledged helps a lot. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
How's the weather back in Toronto right now?
It's actually cold today.
Oh God, it's ugly here.
Like raining?
Just ugly. Yeah, like it was like freezing rain this afternoon. I can't,
Wow.
you know, and it's going to be, you know, next weekend's going to be 24, but you just
Yeah.
can't figure out this weather these days, huh?
Yeah, no, I know it's completely unreasonable. I mean, we've last week we were, I mean, it was almost, I think 20 got up to 22 degrees, you know, which is
Yeah.
quite warm, right? Not yeah no I think I rode a bike home and I was actually sweating on the way home, which is strange. I felt like it's kind of like that's well I lived in Vancouver for 8 months and I remember riding my bike in February going, I'm riding my bike in February. That was like so strange for somebody from Ontario, right?
Well, but you get rain. I mean, I love
Yeah,
Vancouver, but I got to get out of here twice a year and go somewhere warm every
right.
winter. I go somewhere in January and somewhere in April or March, you know, just to get away.
Yeah, I yeah, I mean, I gotta say that's the one thing I liked Vancouver, like from the point of view of like, you know, nice weather. But I mean, I like rain, and I mean, I went into Vancouver liking rain, and but I gotta say, like the sky is always kind of gray. Mind you, I was never there in a July and August, which I hear are like the fabulous months, right? To be in
September is
BC.
actually, I think, the best month.
Yeah,
It's fabulous. But July and August, it depends on when the summer starts, but yeah, we get 3 or 4 good months.
I mean, like I lived in Richmond, and no, I worked in Richmond, and I lived in Surrey, and we used to go to like, you know, Stanley Park and ride our bikes around and that kind of stuff. It was lots of fun. Like, but I moved in October, the very like, yeah, I think it was like the end of October, and it was like horrible weather driving through Canada to get to Vancouver, and then all through that year, and then I left in April. So I mean, I didn't get to experience the best of BC from what I hear anyway, right? You know, but yeah, life moved on and I had to go with it. Do you listen to our show at all, or oh
All
yeah,
the time. It's one of
oh
my
cool,
ones that I queue up and listen to. So
nice. Yeah,
yeah, it's good stuff. Yeah, I just listened to the Sean Allen one. But no, that wasn't you. See, I mix them all up. It was Daniel was the last one that you had.
Yes, right? Daniel Seinberg, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah. But yeah, and you know, I sort of switch between iOS podcasts, a lot of CBC podcasts.
Like Spark, I listen to Spark and Persuasion and
Yeah, exactly. And we listen to a lot of CBC on the radio here. It's always got the radio on. So
So let me ask you a question. When you ask Siri to play CBC, do you have to specify Vancouver? Because we have to say, you know, hey, followed by the word Siri, play CBC Radio 1 Toronto. Otherwise, she plays Ottawa.
I don't ever ask Siri to play CBC.
No?
We actually have a real radio that
Oh, radio. Wow. Is that like with buttons and dials and stuff?
Yeah. I don't know. My wife is technically challenged.
Oh, yeah.
So we've got a radio in the kitchen that's always on. If my wife walks into any room where there's a radio, she'll turn the radio on, and the only station she listens to is CBC.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so we use Siri for listening to music. You know, we'll just tell it to play Apple music. We've got some Echoes as well, so we can do that. We have Sirius, so we can listen to whatever we want on Sirius satellite.
Yeah. Well, because I have, my wife's phone is one of my test phones, right? Like that's sort of been the experience for her for the last 12 years. So, you know, we both have Macs and iPads and watches and phones. And yeah, she started out like not being, you know, like not being very tech savvy either. Although she's always been technical. That's actually her SE30 behind me, right? From back in the 80s, right? So we've both been on computers long enough, right? But we switched over to using HomePods and Amazon. We have an Amazon Echo. Or two, we have a Google Home, a couple of Google Homes as well. So we use whatever room we're in. You know, we'll just tell it to throw on the CBC and listen to it on TuneIn.
Okay.
But yeah, so and you know, we're now unlocking our front door with our watches and all good stuff, right?
Yeah, I've got that too, it's a shortcut that I made on my phone.
Yeah.
To unlock and lock the door.
Yeah, we do that too. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the trouble is if it's on your home screen, you can accidentally tap that button and it might open or close the door. So I've been away on vacation and somehow accidentally opened the door. I come home from vacation and my door is wide. It's not open, but it's unlocked, right?
Yeah, yeah. So I did the same thing. I went to Ireland, I think Ireland or Portugal last year, and it was like Wednesday. We left on a Sunday. And on Wednesday, I went to check my app because I think it's my door lock at the time it was an August lock. It was no longer, but I looked at the thing and I went, oh my God, I forgot to lock the door. So thankfully I was able to lock it from Portugal, you know, which is kind of cool, right? But
And my car, I have a Ford, so I can start and stop and open the door of my car from my phone too. So it's cool.
Yeah, no, we have the old, I still use a key for my car, but.
Because
my fob died years ago, so.
Okay. Yeah. I don't even know if my key, I don't, there is no key for my car. It'll take my, it'll
it
just,
like
it just
push,
opens when I walk.
Push ignition kind of thing?
Yeah, it's got, push ignition, right?
Yeah,
you just walk up to the car and it unlocks. So it's a fob, But there is no physical key as far as I know.
How do you open
to get
the
into it?
Or get, what about when you, is there, oh, it's a valet, is there a valet mode or?
Yeah, that's good. I don't know. I never use valet parking. I hardly drive anymore. My wife's got an EV.
Oh yeah.
So it just makes much more sense to go in her car everywhere, right?
Which one does she have?
You've got the Bolt. Same as what Daniel has, a Chevy Bolt. It's a great car.
Yeah.
It's great. So
I was looking at that one too, because that actually has buttons on the radio, right?
Yeah. My wife loves analog kinds of things for sure.
No, I'm telling you. I shudder to think about all the people who have touchscreens in their their cars, because you know, how many phone screens have you gone through? How many, like, they just stopped working after a while, right? So
yeah.
The touch died. I'm like, camera on my computer here is an iPhone 10, and the screen touch stopped working. I had to get that replaced. And it's a known defect in the iPhone 10 and iPhone 11, right? So I don't know. I mean, I restored my original iPads recently. I had to, you know, because I wanted to be able to look at my old apps, right? Because they won't run on the new devices anymore, and they're not on the store anymore. But this technology just doesn't last. Not like you know, I have my car is a 2004 Honda CRV, right? And the one before that was a 97. Our next car will be an EV.
Yeah.
And when I was looking at I went to the car show with my grandson in a few months ago here in Toronto. And yeah, the Bolt was the one that came to the top of my list in terms of which car I would go with.
Well, I've got my name on the list for a couple of plug-in hybrids for myself. We used to have a home in Kelowna in the interior of British Columbia. Four hours away.
Mm-hmm.
And so driving back and forth. So we still go back up and back and forth all the time up there. And you get this range anxiety when you go with an EV.
Yeah.
And so we've done that once. And the rest of the time we take my car. So I want to be able to take longer trips. So a plug-in hybrid makes sense. Because if I drive around the city, I seldom am ever out for more than 40 or 50 K, which is what you get on a plug-in hybrid on the charge.
Right.
So I will use very, very little gas, but I still have that if I want to go for a longer drive, right?
And
have gas. So I'm looking at the Kia Niro and the Ford Escape plug-in hybrid.
Yeah, my stepson has a RAV4, I think, and because he bought our cottage from us, and it's like two hours away, right? I think same sort of thing. In the city, they use the EV part, but when they're driving, they use it's a plug-in hybrid. Yeah, so you put gas in it for the long hauls, right? So right. I was the same thing when I had the cottage. It was like, I don't think I'll ever own an EV.
You don't want to be stuck. Yeah.
Well, I've run out of gas on the way home, like even on long weekends when they close up the, you know, after May, between May 24th and Labor Day, the gas stations are open late. But after that, like it's, you know, the summer cottagers go home and the gas stations close at 6 p.m. on Sunday. So you better have a full tank before you try and head home. Yeah. Right?
Well, if my wife sees our gas tank below half, she starts to panic. So I'm always making sure that it's pretty close to full anytime she gets in it. So, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. We're down to one car because I live in the city. So I take the streetcar or ride a bike to work kind of thing when I go into the office.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
we were at one car for quite a while. And then my wife, one day I was out and she was thoroughly ticked off because she wanted to go out and I had the car. So next day she goes out and buys a car.
Nice. You know, sort of, yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, power to her. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. You got your independence. We downsized from our home and moved to central part of North Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So I walk everywhere.
Right.
And I even, you know, I take public transportation to go into Vancouver City. I don't want to drive into the city.
Yeah.
And we ride bikes. And we've recently just got e-bikes a year or so ago. That has
so is it Lionsgate Bridge you would cross to go into the city kind of thing?
Either Lionsgate or First Narrow or Second Narrow. It's called the Iron Workers Memorial Bridge.
Right.
Either of those. We do, you know, do loops around those bridges and through the city. So we get out on our bikes all the time. That's the nice thing about Vancouver is you can be biking at any time of the year, basically, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I really enjoyed that. The only hassle about for those of you driving at home, the only hassle about Vancouver is it's bridges everywhere. You know, like the main part of the island, and if you want to go to the airport, you got to go on a bridge. If you want to go to Richmond, you have to go on a bridge. You know, if you want to go to Surrey, you have to go across a bridge. North Vancouver is two bridges, as you said, right?
So. Yeah. And there's no freeway through the city.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, it stops when you get to.
Where does the Trans-Canada end in Vancouver?
Right. The Trans-Canada Highway turns into what's called the upper levels, goes right almost by my place. It goes out to Horseshoe Bay, which is that's sort of the terminus, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it really doesn't pick up to be a freeway until you get to between Vancouver and Burnaby. Basically, that's where the freeway starts.
Right.
Yeah. So there is no freeway running through the city as you see in most cities.
But, when people want to go to the airport, can they take the what do you call that? The
SkyTrain?
SkyTrain, yeah.
Yeah. I can walk to the C bus, which is the, instead of taking a bridge across, I can take the C bus across to Vancouver.
Across one to Fuca Strait or whatever?
Georgia Strait.
Georgia Strait, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And so, yeah, I just take a C bus. It's just a regular transit fee. And then right there, I can take the SkyTrain that'll take me directly to the airport. So
how
I never
often
have to
does
park
the bus
the
cross the strait there?
Every 10 minutes.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. 10 minutes during tea times, 15 minutes in the in-between times, and half an hour in the off hours.
That's not
7 days a week. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's great. And it's huge. It's, you know, you never have to worry about it. It's comfortable. Hmm. And the sky trains run every 2 or 3 minutes, you know, back and forth around. So yeah, it's a good transportation system for sure.
Yeah. Back at, I don't know if you were there in Expo 86, but I actually did the banners for Expo 86.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Expo is what changed Vancouver.
Yeah. It's when they put the SkyTrain in, right? Yeah.
They put the SkyTrain in. They changed the liquor laws so that you could now drink liquor on a Sunday. Restaurants could serve liquor.
Oh, wow.
You know, there was no, the stores were closed on Sundays.
Right.
All of that changed in 86 when Expo came in. And Vancouver's never looked back. I mean, it's now known for their variety of restaurants and things. So it's a real metropolitan city now. You know, it never used to be back in the day, but Vancouver's a great city to be in, you know.
Yeah. No, I used to travel around quite a bit when I was like on weekends, you know, because I was working. Like I said, I was there by myself. My wife stayed here in Ontario. She was hanging on by, you know, her dying nails here. Like, you know, it took a while to get her to agree to move out there. But yeah, so I would spend the weekends riding my bike around and, you know, Newton and around Richmond and all Surrey and all that kind of stuff. And yeah, go up to Westminster.
What year was this?
Would have been 96.
Okay.
Yeah, a long time ago. So
yeah. Have you not been back since?
I have actually, no, I've only to fly. Like when we went to Hawaii, we flew through Vancouver. So we had a layover. Oh, okay. So we got out and checked out the cherry blossoms. It was April. So
it's cherry blossom season right now. Yeah. 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 So it's beautiful.
Last year, 2 years ago, I guess.
Yeah. Paul Hudson was here last week, the week before, and I think it rained every single day he was here. I felt so guilty.
Yeah.
So he messaged me and said, we're thinking of renting a car because the weather is so bad. Where are you going to go? So they went up to Whistler, but I had to check first to see whether or not he needed snow tires. And, you know, I guess he was successful because there's pictures of him up in the mountains up at Whistler. But it's been an ugly spring, really has. But then that's not necessarily unusual, but it's been cold and ugly.
Yeah. Well, like I said, we had that weird sort of midsummer, and now we're back into hopefully we've seen the worst of it, because the buds are coming out now on the trees, and you know, the tulips are coming up, and daffodils are all full bloom. So
I had to get away to Palm Springs last month just for a week, just to dry out, you know.
For sure. So what about WWDC? Would you head down to
I don't think so. I didn't get a ticket. It certainly, if I got a ticket, I would have gone. It's a long way to go for the limit, I mean, you know, for what, right? To network with people. I think I'd rather do that at a real conference. So if there was, as there used to be at WWC, those side conferences, right? It would make it much more sense to go down and Elk Conf, right, and spend it. But to go down there, you know, to chit chat, and you know, it's a bit of a crapshoot. So no, I don't think I'm going down this year.
Yeah, and we don't have 360 iDev in Denver anymore. They've packed up their tent. So
yeah.
It's too bad.
Yeah, I probably should have gone to the Chicago one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, that deep dish Swift.
Yeah, they're sold out. I'm on the waiting list.
yeah. But it's closer for you. I mean, everywhere else is a long way for me to go, right?
That's true. Yeah.
Europe's got so many. You know, there's just so much happening over in Europe. But
you've also got you can go to the other side too. You can go to Japan and conferences out there too.
Yeah.
There's a few out that way too.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's just so damn expensive to travel these days.
Yeah. Well, yeah, especially between Vancouver and the rest of Canada for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And drive down.
Never figure that out. It's cheaper to go to the States.
Down to Seattle. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's, it's not great. So,
cool.
Yeah.
Well, great chatting with you.
Yeah. I appreciate the opportunity.